The date is August 19th, 2010. We are at the Amelia Island Museum of History at 233 South 3rd Street, Fernandina Beach, Florida. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Heritage Keepers Project. We are interviewing Charles Laverne Albert. He was born June 29, 1932 in Nassauville, Florida. My name is Bobby Faust, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Frank Reitinger, who will operate the recording equipment, and Pat Williams as another Heritage Keepers interviewer. I will now begin the interview. Charles, why don't we start with your birth? You were born in Nassauville. Would you tell me a little about that community?
Okay. Nassauville was very, I would say, pristine to a certain extent. Only two or three families. About three Afro-American families where I lived, and the rest four or five whites. And we had good communication, the fact that we had to share materials such as food, and we planted, my dad planted crop, and we spent a lot of time, I did, learning how to feed the hogs, mm-hmm. milk the cows, cut marsh grass for the horse. So it was a very productive early life for us.
We had things to do. Was your family farmers predominantly?
Yeah, that's right. My dad, my family were farmers, sort of their background occupation. But my dad started off as a picking oysters and fishing. Then when ITT Rainier came in and container, everybody just got excited, and he started working the mill, ITT Rainier. And he was there for years, and that's where he retired from. And he raised us as an occupant of laboring at that mill.
What was his job at Rainier?
He was just a laborer.
As I understand it, there was segregation in jobs at Rainier.
Oh,
is that
absolutely
true?
Yes.
And so
there was segregation everywhere.
So African Americans could only have certain menial jobs, and the more skilled people, or were African Americans allowed to have some of the skilled jobs at the local?
I don't know all the what thoughts as far as the jobs concerned, but I do know African American were labor, that they were more labor intensive,
mm-hmm.
and when the skill, those who was with the skilled jobs, they work alongside others and they were trained. In other words, if you reached a certain status on your job and certain age, they may call you in and give you a job doing certain things.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't a wholesale situation. The wholesale occupation was labor intensive.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, I understand that. How many generations does your family go back in this area?
Quite a few. I can't be exact.
Okay.
But we started off. My grandfather was Prince Albert. And Prince Albert came here as a result of living on Crane Island.
Oh.
Sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, what I gather from history was that we Afro-Americans lived along the river edges. And the reason for that was when the pirates came in, Afro-Americans would be first to give the information that it's dangerous, somebody's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there was so much waterfront property.
Oh, I see.
Because we were waterfront dwellers out in Nassauville. Matter of fact, my family has about 8 acres on the river out in Nassauville at this time. And Prince Albert was, he was sort of a leader in the community of the people. He started develop a church, and it's my church that we're trying to keep going now, called Prince Chapel AME.
Mm-hmm.
My dad down in Goffin, you've seen Goffinville area.
Yes.
Well, Goffin, Mr. Saul Goffin, was the person who came and he developed a meatpacking company there. And people lived in houses all along going down to the waterfront.
So this would have been in the late 19th, early 20th century?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked the laborers and gave them jobs. And the interesting thing about it, he had a concession area, concessionaire place. And they had to, he paid the workers off with his money. I laugh about that now when I hear about it, but he paid the workers off, so when they worked, they bought the products from him and paid him right back his money. So it was very interesting. My mother told me about those situations, and my mother and grandmother worked along those areas.
Worked also in...
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Your mother obviously worked on the farm, too.
Absolutely.
Did she have any other jobs outside of the farm and the home?
Other than the meatpacking
right.
situation with Goffin, Goffinville.
Did that meatpacking continue after your grandfather died? Or?
Yes.
Okay, so your family continued to run that, too?
Right. They work along
wow.
with it, and then they... continued to set up those products until they went out of business in the later years. Some of the descendants are in Jacksonville now are from the Goffins family. Amelia De Leon and those people, they live in Jacksonville. And it was just Goffin, he allowed us to build a church, his first church. And my grandfather, they said he was the preacher, and he set it up, Prince Albert. And so we named the church Prince Chapel. So it's now Prince Chapel out on Hendricks Road. If you ever go to Nassauville and you see a sign say Prince Chapel AME, that's where we moved the church. My dad donated 2 acres of land along those in that area, and he... we built the church there about 7-8 years ago. And we have a small membership at this time. We're trying to increase our membership in that area.
Wow. It's fascinating.
Could you tell us your mother and your father's name?
Oh, yes. My mother was Pearl Albert, and my father was Charles Albert Sr.
What was it like growing up in Nassauville? Was there a bridge to Amelia Island at the time, or?
Yes,
okay.
There was a bridge. But the growing up in Nassauville, we were a bit primitive because there weren't many automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad got to the point after he worked a while, he purchased a car. And we would have to accommodate so many of the people who were living in the area because they needed transportation. He was pretty good about letting them, picking them up and bringing them to town and that sort of thing. The road was all mud and clay. It was fine during dry weather, but when it rained like we had the heavy rains this past weekend, you couldn't go in and out of it. It was just so muddy. And jumping the gun here, but we had some problems with school buses and all that sort of thing. We'll talk about that later.
Well, no, tell me about your experiences. You went to Nassauville Elementary
School? One room school, 1st through 8th grade. And we attended that school. I attended that school until I got in 5th grade.
And about how many students were in that school?
It was approximately 10 to 12,
oh.
plus or minus.
10 to 12 for all?
For the whole enrollment.
First to eighth grade.
Right.
Did most African-American children attend school at least for a little bit of time?
Yes, they did. They attended school till they reached about 6th or 7th grade. And my grandmother was very sensitive about education. We didn't have any choice but to go to school. I mean, we had to work when we got home, but that was the thing. She started us all with the alphabet. Like, we'd work in the field. When we go home, we had to sit and learn the alphabet. And when we started school, we knew those things. And she kept saying that if you stay around me, I'm going to see that you go to school and get an education. And then the county, Nassau County, consolidated the educational system for Afro-Americans, and that's when we came over to Peck High School.
Okay.
And I was in the fifth grade then.
1960.
No. That was when I came over when we came over to Peck High School, it was approximately...
That would be in the 40s.
Yeah, it was 40s, because I graduated in 49. So it was 42, 43, somewhere along there. Excuse me.
And so, I mean, even though we know Peck as Peck High School, mm-hmm. it was an elementary school as well as
Absolutely.
A high school?
Absolutely. Elementary
school. So it was everything. This is where all the African-American students from the whole county went to school there?
From the, not the whole county.
Okay.
From Yulee back to this area.
Okay.
A lot of the students, and I think about them now, they didn't have transportation to get to the high school.
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
No, they had to ride. Mac Junkin had a bus line, and their families had to scrap money for them to ride the bus in to come to school. And when they didn't ride the bus, they caught the trucks, the pulpit trucks. The trucks going to the mill, back and forth. They knew what corners to stand on. If sooner or later the truck would come by, and it would pick them up and take them in and out back home and what have you. Then some of the parents were in the area were very nice about letting the kids stay until they found a way to get home and whatever. Yeah.
When you were going to school, did you notice a different quality in education between your first to fifth grade at that one-room schoolhouse and then when you went to Peck?
Yes, I did, but... I was sort of overwhelmed at how well equipped we were, because my teacher was, and I sympathize with her quite a bit, because she had to catch a ride from O'Neill.
Wow.
You know where O'Neill is?
Yes.
And walk all the way down to Hendricks Road. And a lot of times, the people who work at the mill, they would pick her up. Then there were times no one picked her up. So she had to keep up pair of galoshes all the time because she had to walk across the pond and what have you. And she really struggled in order to reach us and teach us and give us education. And the thing is about it, we were so excited about education because our parents stressed that. And I get sort of upset. I can't talk about today now, but... I get upset when we talk about the kids not doing this and the kids not doing that. That's the parents' job. And I was lucky to have parents who made sure that we followed certain things and got information and been enthused, so to speak, from home, not from standing around some guys on the street.
Right.
And that's where we are. That's where the world's going now. But education in that one-room school was very exciting. I always was a person who could, I don't want to talk about myself, but I was a person who could spell. And I was in second grade, and the guys, eighth graders, they would have spelling lessons, and they couldn't, a lot of words they couldn't spell. And the teacher, Miss Bryant, would call on me to spell for those guys, and they would be angry with me. But those were exciting times. Those were exciting times.
Do you remember any childhood stories or stories from school other than that one that you might want to share with us? Any particular incidents?
Oh, yes, quite a few. One to stand out, we walked from that one-room school to home, and while walking, sometimes the whites would, the buses would pass us, and they would have things to throw at us, so we learned right quick that to get back away from the roads, you know, because they're going to throw things at you.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, we were, after we attended Peck High School, the Reverend L.S. Morrison developed a bus system. He purchased a bus, I think, from his own funds. His offspring of children is out at where you see O'Neill Memorial,
mm-hmm.
a church there by Lowe's.
Yeah.
That was his, in other words, some of his family and offspring that running that now. But he bought the bus, and that gave us incentives to get to school because he drove the bus back and forth from Nassauville and a certain distance up toward Chester, not all the way to Chester, but toward that area, and he could pick up kids and bring them in the Fernandina, and we were bused in quite a bit.
But you all had to pay a little amount of money to...
No.
Oh, that was free. He did that.
Yes.
What did you do for growing up for fun?
For fun?
Yeah.
Worked.
I understand that.
When I got after school, and since you mentioned that, I'm real serious about work because we were riding the bus. We didn't want the bus not to show up. We wanted the bus to come so we could go to school because
right.
had the bus not, if the roads got impassive or something like that, then we had to stay home and work all day. So we wanted that bus to make sure it showed up no matter how bad the weather was. But we had a lot to do at all times. My dad stressed a job for us to do. And once he got home in the afternoon, he'd always check to see whether we carried out his assignments. And we had to make sure we carried them out.
Did you do, once you became a teenager and you were at Peck High School, did you spend any time on Amelia Island, at the beach or the movie theater, anything like that?
Once I reached 11th and 12th grade,
mm-hmm.
I was able to drive. And my dad, every once in a while, would let us have the car to go to the American Beach and we didn't go to the movie very often, but we went to the movie every once in a while. But that was the only time that we got a chance to come over to Fernandina and have any type of exercises of any way.
I know that Sheriff Youngblood was quite a figure
at
the time that you were growing up in the late 40s and early 50s, I think. Tell me a little about Sheriff Youngblood.
Sheriff Youngblood, I thought, was an asset to this county. And the reason I say he was an asset is because he arrested everybody. It doesn't make any difference whether you... white, green, yellow, black, or purple. If you broke the law, that was it. And he did not allow any member of the Ku Klux Klan to cross that bridge.
Hmm.
No. If you came here and was a Klansman, you better make sure you kept it hid because he'd have you gone. And I know in Ocean Way, I passed through the Ocean Way area, and every Saturday evening, they had a Klan rally there, everybody in their white robes and everything.
Where was Ocean Way?
Ocean Way is, you know where the airport is?
Oh, okay.
You know all that development in there?
Uh-huh.
All that was Ocean Way.
Okay.
And every Friday evening, or Saturday evening, they had a Klan rally there. But they wanted to bring that Klan rally over here to Fernandina, Nassau County.
Mm-hmm.
And Sheriff Youngblood, he didn't have it. And we were lucky enough, because of that, not to have many just outright drastic punishment of whites against blacks and that sort of thing, because he didn't stand for it.
That's really very forward thinking of him at the time.
Oh, yes.
And there were no blacks on the in the sheriff's department,
no.
though.
No, not at that time.
Uh-huh. And as far as the recreation goes, of course, you mentioned American Beach, which was the beach for African Americans because the white beaches mm-hmm. were segregated. What about the Island Theater?
Island Theater. I didn't get a chance to go to Island Theater very often, but I've heard the students talk about it, and I remember only about one movie I attend, and I sneaked off to do that because we were supposed to have a practice for play, senior class play, and them having the play practice, we didn't, so we went to the movie that night. And the movie I remember vividly was called Pinky.
Pinky.
You remember that movie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. That was the black girl was, if I remember, a little bit of it. But the point about the movie was this. You had, the blacks were upstairs, and the whites were downstairs. And you were made sure that you were upstairs in that area. And there was a patrol guy who walked and made sure that there wasn't anything thrown down below and all that. And that's all I can remember about the movie, because we didn't have a chance to go living out so far in the country.
Right. Let's see, what year did you graduate from Peck?
1949.
Yes. Do you have any experiences at Peck and the school? Because I understand that Peck was one of the top schools in the state and mm-hmm. in the country.
Yes.
Are there any experiences or remembrances that you have that you might want to share with us
about
education?
One real vivid. That's where I met my wife.
And your wife's name is?
Ernie. E-R-N-I-E. And I tell the story all the time. We went to the prom, and I took to the prom, but what happened, guys would get around the bathrooms and what have you, and they'd have their bull sessions, you know, guys just talking, and they'd start talking about, Amanda, are you getting your wife a corsage? I mean, your girlfriend a corsage? And I'm not even in the conversation, but I'm in the other side of the bathroom listening. And they said, no, man, I'm not getting a girl any corsage or anything. Let them just suffer. Let them get the parents. So my mother would give me the money to go to Sailor downtown here and purchase a corsage during the day because I rode the bus. I couldn't do it in the afternoon.
Right.
So this particular guy said, oh, my goodness, I'll take my mother money back. I don't need to get a corsage. The guy's not getting a corsage. And I learned the greatest lesson I ever learned in my life from that day, because I went back home and I told my mother, I said, Mother, I don't need a corsage. I'm not getting one. Here's your money. So that night when I went to pick her up, she met me at the door and she said, and during that time, people would come from all about just to see the guys take the girl to the prom. We had all our relatives out of Georgia and whatnot. And I walked to the door and she reached for the corsage. And I said, I don't have one. And she was living with her grandmother. And during that time, the grandmothers were instrumental. What they had the greatest voice in the house. And she had a grandmother that didn't play. And when she went back and I heard her tell her, say, he didn't get me a corsage. And she went on. I looked back to make sure there wasn't anything blocking me because I was going to run. I thought she was coming out with a gun. She said, that's sorry, no good. So he's thinking, who you think he's taking? You know, to be a tramp. And from that day, well, her aunt was there with her. And she went out and picked a flower, made an orchid. She had the best flour in the place. Everybody was wondering where she got it from. And but the moral of this whole situation was, you make your decision not based on what somebody else is doing, somebody else thinking. And that stuck with me, and I know she's she know I tell that story where I go. But then she was so instrumental, and she was always good with sewing. And my dad was a lot of the guys when they got in home ec, they said they weren't gonna take home ec. That was a girl's thing. And I said, well, I'm not gonna take home ec either. So the boys would go out and play basketball. And we had a clay court, we would go out and play. And this particular day, I went out and played basketball. And my teacher went and told my dad that I didn't come to my home ec class. And my dad said, I bet you won't miss another one. So I was the only guy sitting up in the home ec class. You're talking about embarrassing? Because those guys really whipped me with their tongues, talking about what a sissy I was, you know. And then the Lord came and spoke to me and said, you know, that girl there, that'll be you. She'll make you a good wife. Just as clear as day. And ever since then, we've been together. We've been together for 52 years.
Wow. So when did you get married?
We got married in 58.
58. So you had already been through some of your college and all of that.
She had graduated from Florida A&M, and I was in the process of going to Florida A&M at the time because I got out of the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't graduate till 59 from Florida A&M.
Okay, so let's go back now. It's 1949, and you had graduated from Peck, and was the curriculum different for those people who wanted to go to, who thought they might want to go to college, and those who would not go on to college? I mean, today we have what we call college prep courses and all of that. Or did everybody take the same kind
everybody
of class?
Everybody took the same thing, yes. And the way you applied yourself depended on how well you were ready to go anywhere. You know, that's the main thing.
So after Peck, where did you go to school?
After Peck, mm-hmm. I attended A. Waters College in Jacksonville.
And what did you major in?
During that time, it was just a two-year school.
Uh-huh.
And was just getting the basic academics.
Okay, so it was kind of a college
prep
curriculum.
Right.
Like today, junior colleges, and then you go on to the major college.
Yes.
And any particular experiences there that you want to share?
Well, it was having grown up in the country and to go to a city. It was preparatory for me because I never spent any time in city life, and it gave me a chance to learn people and study people and really get some ideas of just how things in the world should go and what you had to do to prepare yourself. And about that time, I came home and worked for, try to raise some money to go to Florida A&M. And during that time, there wasn't many jobs for Afro-American students. We had a fellow by the name of, out at the mill, supervisor by the name of Jameson. And I went out and told him that I wanted a job for a student, prepare myself. And he said, I'm sorry, but we don't have any so-and-so N-words guys going to school. If you want to work, I got a job for you, but I ain't got no job for you going to those, preparing you to go to no school. So then that was an incentive for me to know that you got to face these issues. And you can't let one thing throw you aside. You got to keep going. So sure enough, I didn't go back to school that fall. I got a job out at Container and the Woodyard. The Woodyard out of Container was where the airport would in the boxcars.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do it now. You see them on them big long trucks now. But during that time, they used to have them boxcars. And I was a teenager, And, well, 19 or 20. And those older men, but all I could hear them saying, well, we'll run that little boy away from here soon. But I was determined. I stayed right with those guys, threw that wood out of those boxcars and had fun. And before you know anything, I was called on to go to military.
Okay, so you had gone to school in Jacksonville,
mm-hmm.
and then you got the job at Container,
right.
And then you were drafted into the military.
Military.
And what year was this?
1953, okay. February 10th, 1953.
So it was, the Korean War was just over?
The Korean War, no, was, it wasn't over.
Okay, it was just...
The Korean War was very hot during that time because... when I got in the service, they kept talking about Korea. And I, with my going near waters, it prepared me with biology. I was a biology student, and I love biology. And I got a job called Graves Registration.
What?
Graves Registration. It was a 1980 MOS, they call it.
Uh-huh.
And... my job was to, we were trained to excavate the soldiers. See, in the war, they don't have time to prepare a grave site and all that sort of thing. They just open a place and put them in the ground. And my job was to go in, we'd go to find those graves, dig those bodies up, and send them back to the United States.
So this was in Korea?
I didn't get that.
Oh, okay.
I haven't gotten there yet.
Okay.
That was the preparation point.
I've got to.
Yeah, preparation. And we, the whole group of us that went to that class, we were on the boat and we were, you talking about praying, because it was hot in Korea. The Koreans were pushing Americans off that show. I think it was called Incheon and Busan.
Oh, right.
It was hot. And we prayed, Lord, end this war, please. We don't want to go to Korea. And we got on a boat called the General William O. Darby. And when we were on that boat, we all sitting around looking sad. Announcement came that the war in Korea has ceased. And you talking about it. We said, Lord, there's got to be a God somewhere. So they came and said, you're not going to Korea. You're going to Japan. So we spent our whole time, I spent my whole military career in Japan at a laboratory where we prepared the bodies were shipped to us, and we prepared them, and we made sure that they were sent back into the States.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, you were in the Army.
Right.
Were you in a segregated or an integrated unit?
It was integrated. At the time that segregation had ended, so by the time I got in there, yes.
Was that... challenging experience for you?
Oh, very challenging, because I got a chance to meet the Japanese people, and I found out that people are the same all over the world, and these people were very smart. And the thing that I noticed about them that really struck me was not one time did I see guys fighting each other. They were very compatible people. And there wasn't any automobiles. And by the time I got back to the States, about 2 years later, automobiles were coming to the United States, Toyotas and all that sort of thing. And see, we had transportation was what they call a rickshaw. And you had to get in that rickshaw, and they drove you around over in that rickshaw. But cars, all of a sudden, they went to work with manufacturing cars. And I mean, they did it fast. And I say that was attributed to people working together and not arguing and fussing with each other.
When you were in the military, did you find any tensions between the African Americans and the white soldiers, being that the integration was really pretty new at this time?
No, because it all depended on the leadership, and the leadership made it compatible for both races. In other words, the Army, we say it all the time, but first to erase the a set of examples of races getting together and being in harmony. And there wasn't any tension that I saw.
Wonderful. Okay. Yep. All right. After you got back and out of the military, then you continued your college education?
That's correct.
And where did you go?
Back to Florida A&M.
Okay, and what was your major there?
My major was biology and agriculture education. Those subjects were sort of compatible because the sciences you take in agriculture, you can use them in biology. And what happened, once I accumulated my subjects, I checked with the education department, and they found out that I was certified in physical science, general science, and chemistry and biology because I took so many different courses down through the years. Yes.
When you started your college career, did you plan on being a teacher, or was that something that just kind of evolved?
No, it just evolved. When I got out of service, I just felt dirty, you know. I just felt like I couldn't fit in with society because I was around just soldiers all the time. And my wife and I, or my girlfriend at that time, we were just walking down the beach. And I said to her, I said, honey, I don't think I'm going back to college. I said, I don't feel like I can fit in. And she said, huh? I said, I don't think I'm going to college. And this is what she said to me. She said, well, you just forget about me. And the next day, I was going to college.
You found a very wise woman.
Yeah, she said you couldn't because she was teaching then. She graduated in 55, and she was teaching out at Yulee, I think it was, no, Callahan Elementary, and we were just courting each other during them times, and I just felt like I didn't want to go to. That's what happened when you leave a segment of society. You just feel like you're not going to be able to adjust.
Right.
And I found out that that's not the case. All you have to do is just
push yourself
a little. That's right. Yeah, that's true.
She was in Yulee, and you were at Florida A&M for
yes.
some of your schooling. So
absolutely.
I imagine that you didn't have much of a social life at Florida A&M. You just kept coming back to Yulee.
I enjoyed Florida A&M, football and all that sort of thing. But I'd come home on weekends and
mm-hmm.
all that.
Are there any particular incidents or any stories you want to tell about your experiences in college and Florida A&M?
No, other than I've had fraternal fraternity. I was got myself oriented with Phi Beta Sigma fraternity. And social life was really
mm-hmm.
good from that standpoint because there was always something to do and keep you occupied and get your work at the same time.
And I bet you they really pushed you there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Very good.
Well, a science major, too. Okay, and when did you graduate?
1959.
And
yes.
What was your first job after graduation?
My first job was graduated in February of 1959, and my first job was at the boys' school in Mariana.
Where is Mariana?
Mariana, Florida.
Uh-huh.
It was a school for juvenile delinquents.
Oh, wow.
And this may stir some information because I worked at that school and they've been having some investigations with the school saying that they had some very terrible significant situation with brutal situation with youngsters, and I didn't find that to be a problem, but they did punish those boys. If they had some problems, they had a punishing team.
Ooh.
Yeah, and that was their way of keeping control, because those boys during that time were some of them pretty rough. But my job was from the education standpoint. I was just would help them with book work and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. What was the name of the school?
Mariana, School for Boys in Mariana. Juvenile Delinquent School in Mariana, Florida. It's a state-run operation.
So how long were you there?
I stayed there approximately 8 months.
Uh-huh.
And my wife was home here teaching. I said, I got to go home. And so I came home and got a job in 1960. Well, I substituted in the educational system as a substitute teacher. I was supposed to go to the post office. That was my idea because I took the test. And they called me twice to work in the postal system, but I started substituting the kids in school. And something just happened that I just couldn't break away from the school system. And then a position came open where I took on a science teaching job at Peck High School in 1960.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that was my first job. And I taught there till integration in 1969.
Okay. Tell me about your experiences at Peck High School. How did you find the students? Were they committed to education? How did you find the educational system? The experiences there?
Yes, the experience was wholesome because the ideas during that time were the fact that when kids came to school, they were more education-minded, and had they not been education-minded, we had contact with the parents, and the parents, you would get them back on track. But now it's a different situation from what we had during that time. And Peck High School turned out some good students and good kids.
Did you find that the facilities at Peck, because you were teaching science, so your laboratory facilities, did you find that you were sufficiently funded?
No. Well, we were not as adequate as when we integrated, but we made up for it with specimens and what have you. We spent quite a bit of time with students bringing in collections. Students would come in and they'd bring animals such as small alligators and the thing. Snakes. I had a couple of rattlesnakes that one of my students' dad killed, and they would bring them in.
Comforting to know they were dead rather than
they
alive.
They were dead, but the thing about it with the rattlesnakes, though, you had to be real careful. Their fangs are still active no matter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they brought them right on the bus, but now you can't do things like that. Yeah. I'm telling you, it was real fun. Real fun.
Now, when you were teaching at Peck, were you living in Fernandina then?
Well, yes, I was living in Fernandina then. I was living different from where I am now, on the 9th Street area, and had moved from my mother and those out in the country.
Yeah. Can we pause and talk a little about life in Fernandina? Geographically, was the city housing patterns fairly segregated? Did blacks live in one area and whites in another, or was it a more integrated experience as far as the housing patterns go?
Well, during that time, Fernandina was predominantly black. And all up and down E Street, they were black homes. And very few whites were in Fernandina at that time. The whites that were here were people who ran the stores, and they were Jews and Greeks and what have you like that. And the homes were, they were all this area, down E Street. When you go down E Street, was house black all the way down. And they used it, most of those people, some of them had stores in which they had during that time and all that sort of thing. Then all of a sudden, it seemed as though the news got out that Fernandina, this property there, mm-hmm. and then slowly the home stopped, started diminishing as far as the black pattern was concerned.
What would you say the percentage was of blacks and other immigrants or whites? Or
I would say percentage-wise, there were approximately, 50 to 55% black. No, it had to be more than that because it wasn't that many. The whites were more out in the outlying areas instead of right here in town. That mm-hmm. was the difference. So approximately 50% in the area and locally right in town were black.
Okay. And some of the whites lived on the beach.
Yeah, that's
along
right.
The beach
that's right,
area.
Along the beach area.
Yeah. Yeah. And then further south of town? Or
further south of town, there was whites. See, they were spread out.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, but as I understand it, one of the incidents I think that were pretty memorable was when the Atlantic Rec Center was opened and there was a public swimming pool provided for white students.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand it, at the same time, they built a pool over at the Peck Center, mm-hmm. The Martin Luther King Center.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea how that came about? Was there negotiations or what happened?
No, what really brought that on was segregation too, the incidents of segregation, but the location of the homes out on the Atlantic Avenue area mm-hmm. were predominantly white at that time. And blacks were predominantly over in the south area, and they would have to get transportation to go to the pool over there. So that let everybody know that we got to do something about a pool here right quick, and that's what brought it on.
Okay, so it was there kind of a political maneuvering to maybe pacify the African American community because the whites were getting a pool and?
Or no, we had. Pretty smart leadership during that time. They could see the need for things. We had a city manager, I forget his name right off, but I think it was C. Era or something like
mm-hmm.
that. And he was pretty good as far as serving the problems that was needed to be served.
Now, up African Americans did not vote in the community, did they, before the Voting Rights Act of 1965? Did you have an opportunity to vote here before then?
During that time, I'm not sure. I'm not fully aware of just what was going on during that time. but I do know I started voting once I got out of college and all that sort of thing, becoming conscious of what needed to be done.
So you voted in the early 1960s?
In the early 1960s, that's right.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you remember any incidents here in Fernandina involved with civil rights movement? I mean, we hear about the Freedom Rides, we hear about sit-ins and things like that. Were there any incidents that you can recall in Fernandina similar?
No, there wasn't any incidents. The reason that there wasn't any incidents is... if it was minor, it was handled by the judicial system. Excuse me. Youngblood was in charge, and he kept things. Instead of getting it all blown up in the paper and what have you, he took care of it. I do remember one situation where one guy brought in a white girl, and by them living on the East Street, the cops came by and they told him, "Say, well, you make sure you get away from this town a certain amount of time." And sure enough, he got away, and everything was handled carefully instead of people just raising Cain over it. And they just complied.
Mm-hmm. At this time, was the police force totally white?
Totally white.
Do you recall when African Americans started serving in the police force?
It started, I would say 1961, 62, plus or minus, a deputy.
Mm-hmm.
Black deputies were hired from the county level. But as far as the city is concerned, there wasn't any black policemen.
So the county sheriff's office.
Right, from the county sheriff's office, that's right.
Okay. About 1966, I think it was, Fernandina started the process of integrating schools.
Yes, that's right.
And as I understand it, it was a gradual integration.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first year, and you were teaching at Peck at
right.
this time, for the first year... Mm-hmm. I think there were supposed to be less than 10 black students would go to Fernandina Beach High School.
Absolutely.
Were those students selected?
It was a parent, parental motivated. The parents decided they wanted their kids to go to Fernandina Beach High School. And it was done from a very subtle and quiet situation. There wasn't any problem. Because most of the blacks stayed at Peck. And just some parents say, well, I want my kid to go to this predominantly white school, and I'm going to start them off now. And then finally, in 69, it was total integration. And everybody just came in, went in together.
Were the students who went that first year, did they tend to be the brightest students, or were they just the random?
At random, the parental motivated.
Among the whites, there was a rumor that the NAACP had paid those students to go to Fernandina Beach. Had you heard anything about that?
No. If it was done from a chapter not here.
Okay.
It could have been just a rumor in the white
community, and
yeah.
not true at all. But
never
I had heard
of that. This is my first time here. The NAACP never have heard too much money.
In 1969, when Peck, those early years before 1969, you read about the incidents in different schools across
mm-hmm.
the country. Were there any incidents here, any racial tensions, or did you feel that the white students pretty much accepted that integration was going to happen?
Yes, I said we didn't have any strife or any problem. And I said it was because of the geography of the area. In other words, if I taught your kid and they gave me a problem, I could, by the island being so small, I'd find you mm-hmm. by 3 o'clock. I'd let you know that I had a problem with your child today. And they kept it, instead of getting through into the press and all that sort of thing, it was done face-to-face. And we never had too many problems.
Now, in 1969, you went to Fernandina Beach? Did you start immediately go from Peck to Fernandina Beach?
In 1969, I went to Fernandina Beach Junior High School.
Uh-huh.
Yes, that's I taught at Fernandina Beach Junior High. And it was so enjoyable. I enjoyed it. Because the kids just respect you. And that was one thing I liked about the parents. They told their kids, okay, you go there and you listen to what that teacher has to say, and if it was different, they, you could talk to them and get it.
And then hit the stop button.